Thank you, the Weiner, for agreeing to come and speak to the school. That's a big kavod. I was just with Rabbi Weiner, actually, a couple of weeks ago in Dallas. We were at the NAJC convention, which is basically Jewish chaplaincy in North America, across the world. So we come together and we meet, and we had a wonderful time together. And so just to introduce Rabbi Weiner, Rabbi Weiner is a senior rabbi and director of the spiritual care department at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. He's responsible for the chaplaincy team, all aspects of spiritual care throughout the whole system. He's the author of a few books on dialectic decision models, as well as a new book that came out, Karen Kaufman, A Jewish Dialectic of Responsibility. He's also the recent kidney donor, hopefully it's mine, of sorts. And so it's a big hug to ask my Weiner to address our show this evening.
Okay, thank you very much. Are you able to hear me and see me clearly? All right, well, thank you for having me. It's really an honor and pleasure to be with all of you. I've actually never been to Detroit in my life, but I would love to go there one day. And I know Detroit, you know, it's from what I've heard, because I know a lot of great people from Detroit, actually, and they're all really wonderful people. It's a little different than LA from my experience. I mean, from what I know, I'm sitting here right now, right on the corner of George Burns Drive and Gracie Allen Road. I'm in the Max Factor Tower, right next door to the Streisand Building, across the street from the Spielberg Building. Our cafeteria is the Ray Charles cafeteria here. You might notice a little bit of like a sort of a Hollywood theme a little bit. And, you know, our hospital being in Hollywood is very concerned about its image. I mean, it's a serious hospital, but it's also, you know, very concerned about brand standards. And one of those standards is that they don't allow, Rosh Tevos. They don't allow abbreviations. So I didn't always know that. So what happened was, interestingly, you know, we have a kosher kitchen, and obviously we keep all the holidays here. We have Shabbos elevators and a kosher kitchen and a mezuzah on every door. And last year, when Erev Shabbos was, and Pesach were the same day, Pesach was Shabbos. And that Erev Shabbos, or Erev Pesach, that Friday afternoon, you know, we sent out a special menu to everybody for Passover, kosher for Passover menu. And I wanted to make sure that everyone would know that it is kosher and it's acceptable. So I made sure to put on the menu that it is, in big letters, all food under the strict rabbinic supervision of the RCC. The RCC here in LA is the Rabbinical Council of California. And I figured everyone in California knows, you know, everyone in LA knows what the RCC stands for. But they didn't check with me first. They just, you know, said they don't allow abbreviations. So I started getting calls Friday afternoon from people like, what's going on here, Rabbi? Is this some kind of joke? You know, is the food really kosher here? I didn't know what they were talking about. So finally someone says to me, you know, Rabbi, you should come up and take a look at this menu. So I came up, and the menu, I had written all food under the strict rabbinic supervision of the RCC. They didn't know what the RCC is in the, you know, in the printing office. And so they published menus which said, all food under the strict rabbinic supervision of Ray Charles. They seem to think that RCC stand for Ray Charles because we have the Ray Charles cafeteria. No one thought to check with me first. So finally, I'm spending the whole day convincing patients, don't worry, Ray Charles is not our mashgiach. The food is really kosher. And I finally convinced everyone, you know, we have hundreds of Jewish patients on an average day. We had almost 200 Jewish patients that day. We had to make phone calls and everything. And finally, at the end in the afternoon, I realized, you know, we have an announcement that goes on the loudspeaker that announces all of our events and services. And I knew they were going to announce our Passover Seder, and they were going to announce our Friday afternoon, you know, Kabbalat Shabbat davening. And I just thought, you know, it's too much. It's too confusing for people. I don't want to announce the Seder and the davening. So I called the operator and I said, you know, let's cancel the Shabbat announcement this week and just announce the Seder. It's going to be easier. So I said, okay, Rabbi, whatever you say, no problem. So everyone's all set. We're getting ready for Shabbos and Pesach, and an announcement comes out over the loudspeaker. you know, there's about 20,000 people in our building on any given moment. It's huge. And it says, ladies and gentlemen, can I have your attention, please? Ladies and gentlemen, this week, Shabbat is canceled. Shabbat is canceled. I thought, oh no. I finally convinced them the food is kosher. Now we're announcing that Shabbat is canceled. So I realized, I learned a lot from that week, and it was a lot of stress. You see, I have a white beard now. Yeah, that was why. It used to be red. But anyways, we do get very difficult, challenging questions. Those were kind of ridiculous. But the questions in the hospital are a challenge, and they really require input from great rabbis. I often have to turn to rabbis much greater, much more experienced than myself to help guide us through these challenging moments. And so I'll share with you a few other stories that just exemplify some of the challenging moments that we've experienced with patients in the hospital and the halachic approaches, because thank God our tradition, the halacha, our mesorah, has guidance for us in all kinds of crazy encounters and challenging halachic dilemmas that arise. Even the most modern, complex scenarios are in fact dealt with by our rabbis. And so it's very inspiring and very helpful. And so I'll give you some examples. So I remember one day I got a call to give someone a blessing before surgery, pre-op blessing. That's a very common question for a chaplain. So I show up in the pre-op area, and I show up to the bay number that the patient who had requested the blessing, and I walk in. There's an elder woman and her daughter there with her, and I kind of walk in and said, "Hi, I'm the rabbi here." And they look at me and they said, "Well, what are you doing here? We didn't ask for a rabbi." So I said, I had to play it off. So I said, I'm just making my rounds, wanted to wish you well. And the daughter says, "Okay, that's nice. You can go now. Thank you." So I'm like, okay, I see they don't want me here, so I don't need to be here. So I'm like, okay, have a nice day. Blessings to you. And as I'm leaving, this man with the big yarmulke and tzitzis out comes in. He says, "Oh, Rabbi, Baruch Hashem, you made it. Yeah, I called for you. Come on in." And he brings me back into the patient's area. And I see the patient and her daughter say, "Oh, you called him. Oh, it figures." And they like roll their eyes. So I see like, oh no, there's some family dynamics going on here. And the son of the patient says, "Rabbi is going to give you a blessing." So they said, no, we already told the rabbi, we don't need any blessings, we're fine, thank you, have a good night. So I'm like, it's okay, I don't need to force a blessing on them. So he says, okay, no problem. And then just as I'm leaving, the daughter of the patient says, actually, Rabbi, now that we have you here, maybe it's a good opportunity for you to settle a little family dispute we're having. So I'm like, oh, great. Like, this is exactly what I need to be put in the middle of this family fight. So the daughter says, "Could you please tell my brother that when my mother dies," remember, this is right before she's going into surgery, pre-op area. The daughter, like, not the best timing. The daughter says, "Rabbi, could you please tell my mother and my brother that when my mother dies and she is cremated, as are her wishes, that she will not burn in, H-E-L-L, as my brother says she will for being cremated." So I'm like, oh gosh, right now, I don't know if this is the best time. She's about to be wheeled into surgery. So I said, I'm sure she'll be fine. The surgery should be, routine. We could talk about it later. So the daughter says, "Well, will she? Is she going to burn?" So she's going to burn. But is she going to burn in H-E-L-L? So I said, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say it that way. Please, I don't think, that's going to happen. And, we could talk about this later. So I thought I'd just satisfy them. The brother says, "Oh, look what the rabbi did not say. You will not get the rabbi to say it's allowed to be cremated, right? You're okay. He's saying he's not going to burn in, in Gehenna, but he's not saying it's allowed, right, Rabbi? You're not going to tell them it's allowed by Judaism, will you?" So now I'm like really being triangulated by this family. I said, "No, of course I will not. That is definitely against Jewish law, and that's not what we do. But I'm happy to discuss this at another time. I think, God willing, everything will be okay. It's a routine surgery. May God bless you. And let's talk about this another time." So finally, I got them to kind of back down. I sort of satisfied both of them. They took the patient into surgery. But afterwards, the son of the patient was like, "Rabbi, come on, you have to have my back. We're both Orthodox Jews here, and I need to represent the tradition to my family and convince them not to cremate my mother." Separately, I talked to the daughter. The daughter said to me, "Rabbi, I respect you and all. I respect our tradition, but my mother is an adult. She's competent. She is of sound mind. She made this decision, and it's her decision. So I need your help in calming down my brother, because no matter what he says, I'm the power of attorney, and this is what we're going to do, because this is what my mother wants. So I tried some of the tricks, but I said to her, like, well, what's the reason? You know, so, sometimes people tell me, oh, it's financial reasons. And I'll say, oh, well, you know, we have a fund that we could pay for a traditional burial. And oftentimes they'll say, oh, great, let's, you know, yeah, if you could pay for it. Or they'll give me other reasons, and I can sort of gently kind of walk them to other options. But this person was adamant. She said, no, she made up her decision. It's for lots of reasons, and I don't need to go over it with you now. We have made this decision, and that's what we're going to do. And whether my brother likes it or not. So please calm him down, because he's not going to have an influence on us. So I felt really stuck.
Recording stopped.
I don't know if you can still hear me or... So then I reached out to a number of great rabbis, a great, great postgame. And, you know, I might not quote by name every person I mentioned here, just because I don't know if they want me to mention their names, but some of the rabbis that I often reach out to are Rav Asher Weiss, Rav Herschel Schechter, Rav Willig, Rabbi Sauer here in Los Angeles. And amongst those, you know, I reached out to a number of Gedolim, and they shared with me that, you know, even though, of course, we should try to encourage people not to choose cremation, and that, of course, we can't tell someone that it's allowed, we can't, you know, that would be Ziyuf HaTorah, that would be totally changing the meaning of the Torah, but when a person has made their decision, and that's what they're going to do, and they are an adult, if they had not made their decision so clearly, or if they had appointed their children and their children were not all were all on the same page that they did not want to follow this, because this question does come up where the children say to me, our parent just died, and then we found out that they want to be cremated. All of us are horrified, and we don't want to do it. So then actually we can go against them, because we can assume, first of all, we can make the legal argument that if they would have known how upset their family would be, they never would have wanted to do this. And furthermore, you know, we say in halacha that the hesped, the eulogy, that's kavod achayim and kavod hames. That's for the honor of the dead and for the living. But the kavura, the burial, is kavod hames. That's for the dead. And we have the option to choose that it's the better, the true kavod for the mace is actually to bury them. And we can go against what they stated when they were alive, and bury them. And we have done that. We've actually done that before, where the whole family is united that they don't want that, and so we don't follow it. But in this case, where the daughter, who is the power of attorney, is adamant that she's following the wishes, so what the postgame told me was, you know, the brother's opposition here is really in some ways it's a Kiddush Hashem, because he's standing up for what's right, but in some ways it can be a Chilul Hashem if he does it too aggressively and just causes a fight in the family. What he should do, they told me, is he has to make it clear. I cannot countenance this act. I cannot be the one that calls the place and makes the arrangements. I can't even be there on the date when it occurs. I can simply tell you that I do not agree with this. I don't support it. If this is what you're going to do, I'm not going to fight you any more than simply expressing my disapproval of it. And then you do what, you know, you're going to just do what you think is right, but please keep me out of it. But maintain the family unity, at least maintain the love and respect amongst the family. Their only way that they will ever have any hashpa or influence or connection to their family is if they're able to be reasonable at some level and maintain that connection. And so since when it comes to the laws of Lifnei Iver, you know, when it's Trei Avrei Denahar, when someone can't do it without you, then you can't help them do it. But when they're going to do it anyways, and you're already registered your protest, these rabbis actually told me that it might be better off simply ensuring the family unity is maintained. Because I see a lot, unfortunately, in the hospital as a chaplain, that at the end of life, unfortunately, these dilemmas and the stress causes families to break down. And it causes horrible pain and fighting. And sometimes the religious individual in the family, but by being extra aggressive, actually turns their family members off even more from religion. And so if there a way can be found to register one's disapproval, but maintain a sense of...
Recording stopped.
So find some way to maintain this family connection despite the challenges they're going through, that should be the goal. And I'll share some more examples of some of these struggles and how, like, we're really, I'm really sharing today is like some of these gray areas, some of these really challenging cases that it's difficult to find direct precedent, and we're choosing between the least bad option, meaning there's no really good choice, and it's not like we can have a simple solution. We have to find it, kind of live in that gray area. We're trying to figure out, like, what's the least bad? What's the most we can accomplish, even though there's no perfect outcome? So I'll give you another case. A man was found on one of the very Jewish streets in Los Angeles, homeless man, in front of a shul. And he was just found down. No one knows anything about him. He was clearly living on the streets. He had a beard, was wearing some kind of a hat, but not a yarmulke or a tzitzis. Didn't seem to be that he was Jewish, but I was called in because they thought, you know, there's some decisions that have to be made about his end-of-life treatment. And the team, out of respect and, you know, which is really beautiful of them, wanted to make sure that if we could figure out any of his values, we treat him in accordance with those values. He was intubated. He was on a respirator. And this team knew that if he's an Orthodox Jew, they would not extubate, meaning they would not take off the respirator in a case where he would die immediately as a result, which is what the case was in this instance. So they asked me, well, what should we do for this individual? Because he is, he is in that category where he'll die right away, and he might be Jewish, but we have no way of knowing. So I called some postgame, and the way they guided me was, well, we have to assume we have no evidence that he is Jewish. So, and we can go by the majority of people who are experiencing homelessness on the streets of Los Angeles, and there are many, are not Jewish, even on the Jewish streets. And so we are not, they said, required to treat him based on halacha. We can treat him based on the laws of the land. But a more complicated case was where we once had a Hasidish woman who was caring for her father. Her father was declining, and it got to the point where he was really in the dying process. And she was being a very strong advocate that Jewish law be followed in every measure, every way possible with this individual. So she wanted to make sure that even at the end of life, he receives nutrition and hydration, as many post-game, many rabbis require, that we cannot withdraw any life-sustaining treatments, even if we might withhold some of them. We distinguish in halacha between withholding and withdrawing, things like that. And she was being, you know, very concerned and a very strong advocate. And as we're talking, the team was getting a little bit frustrated because every question that came up, that they would ask her, you know, what do we want to do? She would ask a different rabbi in her life. And the rabbi sometimes gave contradicting advice. So finally I sat down with her and I said, you know, we really need to have one rabbi guiding you on this. It's really too confusing and not beneficial to be asking so many different rabbis. So who's your rabbi? So she says, well, I have the rabbi whose shul I go to. And then there's the rabbi who did my conversion. So I said, wait a second, you converted? I didn't know that. Did your father convert also? She said, no. So I said, oh, wait, so does that mean that your father, the patient in this case, who we're caring for, so he's not Jewish? So she said, no, he's not. So I said, well, you know, I think we need to ask your rabbi, are we required to follow Jewish law on the treatment at the end of life of a non-Jewish patient? Granted that the advocate, the power of attorney, the daughter is Jewish, definitely, but her father, the patient, is not. So do we have to be going to these lengths? So she said, oh, I didn't even think about that. I guess let's call the rabbi. And he gave a fascinating answer. The rabbi said, you know, halacha recognizes that the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the non-Jews follow the seven Noahide laws. That is also a valid and respectable moral tradition. And in the seven Noahide laws, one of them is dinim, is that they have courts and a system of law. So he said, there is the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. Non-Jews are expected to follow the laws of their land. The laws of their land are considered moral, especially in a basically moral country that we have moral laws. So what's expected of Jewish law is that a non-Jew follows non-Jewish laws, but they're not expected to follow Jewish law. So he said, as long as what they're doing is within the basic parameter of the standards of practice in modern medical ethics, that would be sufficient. And she's not required to provide such aggressive interventions that are required by Jewish law at the end of life, which was fascinating. And that was what we did. And it actually comforted her a lot because he was able to be treated in accordance with American law, and she didn't have to be as adversarial with the team, which is just another, you know, fascinating case. It reminds me of another case, which was a very difficult case. Maybe one of the most difficult cases, actually, as I think about it now, that I experienced, that also required us to really go to the extremes of applying Jewish law. This was a case of a patient who came from out of town. He graduated from yeshiva day school in another city. And after graduating from yeshiva, he didn't go to Israel. He came to Los Angeles, actually, probably the wrong direction, right? And, you know, there are some good things in Los Angeles. There's also some not the good things in Los Angeles. And he got involved with lots of drugs and alcohol and tattoos. And after just being in LA for just 2 years, after graduating high school, he ends up in our emergency room. And the reason I met him, and just by the way, I'm changing small details with every story I tell you to protect the privacy of every patient. But the reason I met him was because the social worker in the emergency room needed to get to know him a little bit, because he comes into the emergency room in an ambulance. She doesn't know his name, his medical history. You know, these things are important when a patient's being treated. But he was being very aggressive and defiant and not really sharing anything. But he did share his name. And the social worker recognized that he had a very Jewish name. So she called me and asked if I could maybe get involved and help out a little bit and see if I could, you know, get to know him a little bit more. So I go down, I talk to him. He did indeed have a very Jewish name. And I see he has, you know, tattoos and he's doing all kinds. He's really had struggled a lot. And all he told me was the neighborhood he's from. He told me the shul that he went to, the yeshiva that he had gone to. And he tells me that he hates his family. He hates his parents. The day he graduated high school is the last day he's seen anyone there. He left. They don't know where in the world he is, and he doesn't care. He never wants to see them again. He's happy they don't know where he is, and he hates them. That's what he tells me. And it was very sad, you know, a horrible, horrible situation. So I was trying to get more information out of him, but even if he was like kind of really aggressive and not so compliant, and I felt like, hey, at least I established rapport. I got to know him a little bit. I'll try more tomorrow. The next day I go to him and the doctors tell me, you know, he's gotten much worse. In fact, he's not really alert anymore the next day. And they said, you know, we really need to know some details about him. First of all, we need to, you know, inform his family. And we have some questions for them. They ask me, were you able to get enough information that you could find his family? Now, I think we all know, if you know the name of an Orthodox Jew and you know what city they're from, what shul they go to, and what yeshiva they went to, I mean, it's not that hard to track them down, right? Just call the rabbi, the shul, and tell them the name or the day school, and it could pretty easily track them down. So I knew I could find them. But the doctors want to find them. They needed me to use that information I got from him to now track him down. I was a little bit conflicted because I was like, he didn't want me to, he clearly didn't want me to contact his family, right? All he told me is that he hates them. He didn't give me permission. He's an adult. He's almost 20 years old now. Am I allowed to contact them? So I, you know, contacted risk management. First of all, a rabbi consulted said, you know, this could be pikuach nefesh. It could be life-saving. So definitely the risk management office at the hospital, you know, the lawyers in our hospital said, yeah, doctors need this information. It's important for him. He's not actively telling you not to call them. He just told you he doesn't like them, but you're going to need to call them. We called the family. When we called them, they shared with me, they had absolutely no idea in the whole world where he was. They were shocked. They hadn't heard from him in 2 years. And they said, you know, we are coming right now. We're getting in our car right now. We're going to buy our tickets from the car and we're going to take the next flight to LA. And they did. And the next day they were there. The patient was still unconscious. And unfortunately, over the next coming days, he declined even more and more. And then came a really difficult question. What happened was they had to intubate the patient. They put him on a respirator. And he didn't like it. He was combative anyways, and it's uncomfortable. And even though he was like kind of out of it, he would yank it out of his mouth. And a respirator, the endotracheal tube goes into one's trachea and into their lungs. So as you can imagine, yanking that out of one's lungs and throat is quite painful and can do a lot of damage. And he needed it because he was now experiencing multi-system organ failure. His lungs were not working properly, and he needed the respirator for his breathing. So they realized in order to keep him alive, we have to sedate him so that he doesn't yank this out anymore. But what happened over those next coming days was that he was declining and the doctor started to feel that he had no chance of recovery. So the parents said, you know, we're here. We flew out to see him. Is there any way we can wake him up? You know, I know you sedated him, but can we take off the sedation so that we can talk to him? We want to tell him that we love him. We want to apologize to him. Maybe he wants to apologize to us. Can't we spend that time with him? And the doctor said, well, here's the thing. He's declining now. He has maybe 2 or 3 months left to live. He's gradually dying. If we extubate him, if we take off the respirator, to do that, we'll have to, you know, we do what you want to do, meaning take off the sedation and wake him up. We'll have to extubate him because they'll yank it out otherwise. But then if we extubate him at this point, he will likely die within a day or two. So now your options are either do nothing and you never really talk to him again, but just do nothing and allow him to gradually die, which he will do over the next 2 or 3 months, or wake him up, talk to him, but that will then cause him to die within a day or two. What do you want to do? So the parents turned to me and they said, Rabbi, we follow halacha. We will do what the halacha says. Guide us. Tell us, what does the halacha say in this instance? So I thought, wow, this is too hard of a question. This is horrible. And I called a posek and he said, definitely, you cannot hasten death. You can't, even though it's beautiful, they want to say goodbye, but you cannot extubate, you cannot take out the respirator, causing him to die faster, even if it's to give them the chance to say goodbye. You have to just let it gradually, you have to let him gradually die. That's the option by halacha. So I told the family that, and they said, okay, if that's what halacha requires, that's what we'll do. That's all we wanted to know. And that was it. The next day, I was sitting in my office, and I get a call from the nurse. And she says, Rabbi, could you come as soon as possible? This patient, the family wants to say vidui with you before the patient dies. So I thought, that's strange. Why do they need me to rush up there? I thought they told me that it's going to be a gradual process over the next 2 or 3 months. I come into the room, and I see that the patient has been extubated. The tube is not in his mouth anymore. The family is gathered around his bed crying. And they say, Rabbi, quick, say vidui. You know, he's dying. So we said the vidui together, and I was there with them for a little while longer, and then actually he died. And I didn't know what happened. I didn't know what was going on. And finally the mother, you know, we said some more prayers, and they called the Chevra Kadisha. Then the mother says to me, can we step outside the room? She says, Rabbi, I know you're probably confused. I know you told us that the rabbi told us we can't extubate, we can't pull the plug, so to speak. But late at night, the sedation medication was running out and they were going to come to refill the bag. And we were just sitting there and we thought, how can we not say goodbye to him? How can we not tell him that we love him? How can we not tell him that we came here to be with him again? And we asked the resident, you know, don't refill the bag, let it go and extubate, wake him up. So they let it run out. And in the morning they extubated him. He gradually woke up. We were terrified how he'd react when he saw us, but he started crying. And he said, thank you for coming. And he said, I'm so sorry about what I've done. And we said to him, no, no, we're sorry. We're so sorry. We love you. And he said, I love you too. And we were all hugging and kissing and making up. And then we were reminiscing and joking about the past. And we were laughing. And we had the most amazing morning together. But then over the course of the day, he got weaker and weaker. And now he died. And on the one hand, it was amazing, she said to me. But she says, on the other hand, now I feel like we killed my son. She says, Rabbi, did I kill my son? So I'm just like, oh, this is horrible. Like, what am I supposed to say to her? Of course I can't say to her she killed her son, but she did go against the rabbi that I consulted. So I had to think of something on the spot. So I said as follows. I said, no, I had to say to her, you know what? I think, in fact, even you did the right thing. I mean, I was trying to comfort her, you know? So I said, you know, and this was a family that really cares about halacha and tradition. I said to her, you know, the Gemara says that Misha Nafalav Mapolas, if a building collapses on someone on Shabbos, you're allowed to dig through the rubble to save their life. So the rabbis say, why? Because Chalel Alav Shabbos Achas, Kadesh Yishmeru Shabbosos Harbe. You can violate one Sabbath so you can observe many more in the future, so you can dig through the rubble. The rabbis say, what if you're not sure if someone's there? They say, still, you could do it. Safek Pekuach Nefesh, Mechalosh, you could still do it. You know, what if the person lost so much blood, you know they won't survive for another week. They're only going to make it for a few hours. Then can you break Shabbos to save their life? The rabbis say, yes, even then you can. But why? It doesn't make sense. They're only going to make it for a few hours. So the Gemara doesn't answer that. But the Meiri commentary there says the reason is because if in those few hours a person can have a chance to do tshuva, it's worth it to be Mechal Shabbos so that they can do tshuva. So I said to her, clearly, now that we see that he did tshuva in those hours, your whole family did tshuva, you repented, you came closer together again. Clearly, it was the right thing. And she said, wow, that is so comforting. I appreciate it. So anyways, finally, I left her at a certain point, and I walked away from the room. I mean, I remember feeling so nervous and so anxious, like, did I say the wrong thing? I don't want to, I can't just make up halacha. I can't just make things up. I mean, I wanted to comfort her, but I was terrified that I said the wrong thing, even though I saw it comforted her. So right away, I called Rav Asher Weiss in Yerushalayim. He is the postdoc for Shaar Tzedek Medical Center, and he's a very amazing rabbi that I'm very close with, and I called him. Thank God he answered, and I told him the story, and I asked him if I said the right thing, and he was quiet. He was totally silent, which made me nervous. I thought, oh no, did I say the wrong thing? Finally, I said, hello, are you there? He said, I'm so sorry, I have to compose myself. I'm crying from this story. And it was a very moving story, and he said to me, not only did you tell her the right thing, I think it's 100% right. I'm going to write a tshuva, which he did, and I'm going to send it to you and give it to the family, which tells them that they did the right thing. And he did. He sent me the tshuva that justified what they did by halacha. Because, you know, first of all, he thought that my quotation of the Meiri was accurate. He also said that, you know, the reason why we don't extubate in Jewish law is, you know, it's based on a few sources. Like, for example, the Ramah on the Shulchan Aruch says that if someone's dying, if someone's a goseis, you cannot move around and shake their body because that will make them die faster. You can't hasten the death of a goseis. But if there is a wood chopper outside just chopping wood, and somehow the noise or the rhythm of that wood chopping is keeping them alive, and they're in the dying process, you're allowed to stop chopping the wood because there is a notion that prolonging the dying process is causing pain to the soul. On the one hand, we do everything we can to prolong life. That's why we can break Shabbos to save a life. We do everything we can to prolong life. But we do not prolong the dying process. We do not prolong death. We do not prolong the suffering of the dying process. When that time has come, we cannot cause someone to die. We can't make them die faster, but we can allow natural death. We can allow them to die naturally. And he said, that's what you did. That's what they did in this case. You can make the argument that in this case it was allowing him to die naturally because they took out the tube and he didn't die right away, and it was simply allowing it. So I think it can be justified. And in fact, he sent me that tshuva to send to them. He said to me also, by the way, he said, you know, it's possible. He says you should never lie. You can never do ziyafat Torah. You can never say the wrong thing about the Torah. Say the wrong halacha. But it could be times when halacha would allow, by the way, for comforting someone who's really suffering, you could be allowed to stretch the truth. Mutar l'shanos mipnei shalom. The Gemara says you could sometimes stretch the truth for the sake of peace, for the sake of comfort, for the sake of yishuv hadas for someone. So anyways, there's that. But the main principle here is we prolong life, we don't prolong dying. There's another story that, by the way, this is based on. The great Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Rabbeinu Kadosh, the author, the editor of the Mishnah, one of the greatest rabbis of all times. When he was dying, he was very sick. He was in his house, and he had to constantly get up and take off his tefillin to go to the bathroom. And he had a maidservant. She was called Amsa the Bay Rebbe, a woman who lived in his house. She was a very wise woman. She's quoted in the Mishnah many times. And also, he had many students. His students were outside the house praying for him to have a refuah shlema. They wanted him to recover. And so did his assistant, the Amsa the Bay Rebbe. But she was inside, and she saw how much he was suffering. While they were outside, they didn't see it firsthand. And at a certain point, she realizes, you know, this is like Yonah says, Tov Mosi Michayai. Sometimes it's better death than life. And so she began to pray for him to recover, for him to die, for God to take him. But she realized that the students' prayer was stronger than hers. There was many of them, there's just one of her. And as long as they were praying, her prayers would not be strong enough and he would stay alive. So she went to the rooftop and took a huge jug and smashed it to the ground. And it made an explosion sound, which startled the students, at which point they stopped praying. And when they stopped praying, she continued to pray for him to die, and he died in that moment. And the Rishon says she did the right thing. And therefore, it's even sometimes allowed to pray for someone to die. So based on this, we have this principle that sometimes you can allow natural death. In fact, what we call DNR, do not resuscitate, for someone who is, you know, based on Judaism allows it. Halacha allows it. If usually, we, like I said, the default is we do everything we can to prolong life. In fact, I'll tell you a story about that in a second. We do everything we can to prolong life. But sometimes if someone is already terminal, there's no cure for their illness and they're in the dying process, and there's nothing that can be done, we can allow natural death. So we call that DNR, do not resuscitate, allow them to die, or AND, allow natural death. I'll give an example, just by the way, on the other side. You know, I once had a patient, a call actually. It wasn't a patient. I got a call. Remember, I answered my phone, and the woman on the other line, I didn't know who it was calling. She just says, "Rabbi, I don't know if you remember me. You once did my father's funeral, and now I have to ask you, unfortunately, to do my son's funeral." I was like, "Oh, wow, that's so sad. Who is this? What's going on?" She says to me, "Well, my son collapsed yesterday. He had a brain aneurysm. Apparently, it was very devastating. He's now in the hospital, not in your hospital, another hospital. They tell me he has no chance of recovery and they should just extubate and let him go. But I said, you know, I have to ask my rabbi first, so I'm calling you. Is it because you work in a hospital? Rabbi, can I extubate and let him die?" So I said, "Wait, he just collapsed yesterday?" And then she said, "Yeah." And I said, "He had a brain bleed?" And she says, "Yes." I said, "You know, it's only been one day." She says, "Yeah, well, but, you know, they said he has no chance." I said, "Yeah, but that's very quick to make such a decision. And really, to extubate in a case where someone will die right away as a result is a big problem by halacha. And also, usually we try to give it a couple of days, see how he does, see how his prognosis is, get a second opinion." I said, "Get a second opinion, give it another day, get a second opinion, and then call me back with a second opinion, and then let's discuss." You know, trying to buy time. So I see she's frustrated with me, but she says, "Okay." She calls the next day. I remember it was a Friday. She says, "Rabbi, they're saying he has no chance of recovery. Can we just let him go?" I was like, "Really?" She says, "Rabbi, I don't want to sound incompassionate, but I don't want to see him suffer any longer. It's just too, I can't bear it anymore." So I said, "So you got a second opinion?" She says, "No, I wasn't able to, but they said it didn't change." So I said, "Let's just do this. Give it the weekend. Let's just give it the weekend. It's Friday now. On Monday, call me back, try to get a second opinion, and we'll discuss then, and we'll figure something out for you." She says, "Okay." All weekend I'm thinking about it, like, what am I going to tell her? Because if he's going to die right away as a result of the extubation, we can't just pull the plug. We can't just pull the plug and let him die. Or then that way it wouldn't be just letting him die. That might be considered causing him to die. So I didn't know what I was going to say. But I was thinking about it. I spoke to a few rabbis. They all said there's no choice. You can't. So Monday came. I'm expecting the call. She didn't call. Tuesday, no call. Wednesday, no call. Thursday, I was at an event. And at this event, there were a number of rabbis. And one rabbi comes over to me and he says, "Oh, aren't you that rabbi from Cedars-Sinai from the hospital?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Oh, isn't that wild what happened, that story that happened at that other hospital?" I said, "How do you know about that?" He said, "Oh, they didn't call you back, did they?" I said, "No." He said, "Oh, they must be ashamed." I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Yeah, they called me Saturday night. And they said, and this rabbi, and I don't want to, I'm not talk bad about anyone. This rabbi wasn't an Orthodox rabbi. I'm not saying that to say anything bad about anyone. But he said, they called me and they said, you know, that rabbi at Cedars-Sinai, he's too Orthodox. So we're calling for your opinion because we know you're not Orthodox. Would you allow it?" And I told them, you know, I felt so bad for her because she was really suffering and it was a really horrible situation. So I said, "Yes, it's allowed." So she said, "Okay, thank you." So she tells the resident, "Okay, we're okay with it. You can extubate." But in the hospital, things move very slowly on the weekends. No one told the residents. No one told them. Monday came along, and they still didn't know. Tuesday came along, and she finally said, "You know, aren't they going to be extubating? Like, what's happening?" And they said, "Oh, we're so sorry. There was a change of, you know, the attending, and yeah, we'll do it tomorrow." So Wednesday comes along, and she starts to notice that the vital signs are much better in the morning. So she, and when they come, they're increasing throughout the day, and she's even noticing his color looks better, and she starts to see throughout the day that he even seems to be reacting to stimuli. So she says, "You know what? Don't do it. Let's not do it." And then finally they confirm, you know what? He is looking somewhat better. Thursday morning, he woke up. To make a long story short, 2 months later, she walks into my office with this young patient. And she says, "Rabbi, I want you to meet the man whose life you saved." I said to her, "You know, I can't take the credit. I didn't save his life. Halacha saved his life. All we were doing there was following halacha. If it wasn't for halacha, I would have told you when you first called me, okay, they're telling you he has no chance, let him go. But I knew halacha doesn't allow it. Jewish law doesn't allow it. So I said, I can't. How can we allow this? So don't thank me. Thank Jewish law." And she appreciated that. And it's just an example. Even though I gave you the examples of how we sometimes allow people to die, we don't always err on the side of letting people die. it's always, you know, it's complicated. I mean, I'll give you another example. It goes back and forth, you know. I remember during COVID, we had the following case. We had a patient who was dying. He was clearly dying. He was declining, but he was intubated. He was on a respirator. And the doctors felt that as long as he's on the respirator, he'll stay alive. But his organs are all shutting down. His whole body's shutting down. He's moving towards death. And they said, you know, he's been on the respirator, the endotracheal tube, the tube that goes in his throat for too long. They said, you know, at this point, he's going to get an infection. It's going to break down. We only allow this usually for 2 weeks. It's already been 3 weeks. They said, you either have to let him go and gradually let him die or put him on a trach. So here was the thing. It was during COVID. And if you remember, there were certain times when Israel was closed, totally closed, no flights. And they were planning on burying him in Israel. That day they announced Israel's closed. No flights going in or out until further notice. So the family realized they could have allowed him to die. The way they would do that, by halacha, would be we can withhold, we can't withdraw. So the way that works sometimes is if patients are on vasopressors, on blood pressure medication, keeping their heart beating, sometimes they'll keep them on the respirator but allow the pressors to run out, especially if a patient's suffering. And they felt, you know, he might be suffering a little bit. He seems to be not, you know, not doing great. They could allow the pressures to run out and not extubate, not withdraw the breathing tube. But the doctor said at this point, if they let the pressures run out, he'll die. But the family said, we want him to live to go to Israel because we want him to be buried in Israel. If he dies today, he'll have to wait for who knows how long. His body will have to wait until it can be buried. So they thought, let's put on the trach in order to keep him alive until Israel opens up. And once Israel opens up again, then allow the medications to run out and then let him die and then bring him to Israel. So should we prolong life for the sake of burial because Israel wasn't open? That was their question. I remember I asked Rabbi Willig this question, Rabbi Mordechai Willig at YU, and I thought his answer was fascinating. He said to me, he said this publicly, that's why I know I can quote this. Rav Asher Weiss also said my answer publicly, so that's why I quoted him. He said, the Mishnah
period stopped.
So Rabbi Willig quoted the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, Perek Dalet. The Mishnah, and it was a fascinating interpretation of that Mishnah, which I think is very profound. The Mishnah says, Yafa sha'achas b'tshuva ma'isim tovim b'olam hazeh, greater is 1 hour of repentance and good deeds in this world, mikol chayei ha'olam haba, than the whole life of the world to come with life of the soul. V'yafa sha'achas shal koras ruach b'olam haba, but better is 1 hour of the pleasure of the soul in the world to come, mikol chayei ha'olam hazeh, from all the pleasure in this world. So he said, this Mishnah implies that the time of in this world is more valuable than our life in the next world. So that should imply prolonged life, because this world is value. But he said, it's only true when we can live a life of tshuva ma'isim tovim. When we can engage in repentance and good deeds in this life, life is worth living. But when a person can no longer interact with the world, and they're in a dying process, at that point, there's no point in prolonging life when a life is in a comatose state, especially when they're suffering and are prolonging suffering. And he said, yeah, it's true that it's a problem of halanas ames. We don't want to leave someone without burial for too long. But the idea of not prolonging the dying process, not prolonging the suffering, overrides the prohibition of halanas ames. He said, do not put in a trach to prolong their dying process. Rather, allow them to die, prepare their body. You'll have a shomer there and everything, prepare their body for burial, and we'll do everything you can to advocate. And as soon as Israel opens, it's not going to be, you know, months and months. As soon as Israel opens, get the body there for burial right away. And that's what happened. And actually, it turned out only to be a couple of days. But I thought his answer was fascinating. It's an important point that, you know, we don't prolong life just for the sake of prolonging life. Right, we err on the side of prolonging life, yes, but it's life when life has value, has meaning, has the ability to still do Torah and mitzvos, which there's lots of levels of that, right? Sometimes just being able to think and interact, that's enough. You can think in Torah, but a person who's totally unconscious or suffering but not able to interact at all, at that point, that's not yafa sha'achas b'tshuva ma'isim tovim. And I thought that was a fascinating answer and very profound. Maybe I'll just give one more case because I thought it was important. And then if you want to ask questions or you can tell me where you want to go from there. I could keep on telling stories, you know, all night. But I know it's late there also. But I'll give you one more case just because I've been talking about so much end of life. Let's talk about one beginning of life case that I had that I thought was fascinating and also very important and profound. This is the case of BRCA, the BRCA, BRCA gene. BRCA is common amongst Ashkenazi Jews, and it could lead, unfortunately, to breast and ovarian cancer in women and prostate cancer in men. And it can be deadly. You know, breast cancer can be deadly if not detected early, and ovarian cancer especially because it's more difficult to detect. The treatment, there are treatments, there's chemotherapies and radiations and different treatments, but obviously if it's too late, it can be very dangerous. And breast cancer can be it can be prevented completely, prophylactically, with a mastectomy, having one's breast removed. And ovarian cancer can be prevented prophylactically by having an oophorectomy, having one's ovaries removed. Of course, having one's ovaries removed has significant ramifications. First of all, it obviously causes early onset menopause. A woman can no longer get pregnant once she has had her ovaries removed. And there is a halachic prohibition against cirrus. Even though it's primarily against men, it also applies to women, at least rabbinically. And according to the Vilna Gaon, by Torah law, women can also not have their ovaries removed. But this is to prevent from getting cancer. The problem is, at the point when they're doing the surgery, they don't have cancer yet. It's being done to prevent getting cancer. So can one engage in this surgery to prevent cancer? You know, it would be one thing you could say, oh, pikuach nefesh, but they don't currently have the cancer. So I first had this case about 15 years ago, and someone asked me, I went to another rabbi, actually not one of the rabbis that I quoted earlier, but an important posek, and that rabbi said, no, actually, she can't. She can't have the surgery because she cannot do cirrus, she cannot become infertile, if she doesn't, she's not currently sick, she doesn't currently have the illness. I was a little bit troubled by that answer, and I did a little bit of research, and I saw the studies were really showing that there's a very high likelihood that the gene leads to the cancer. But how do you make the halachic argument? So I went to Rav Asher Weiss, Shlita, and L'Havdil Ben Chaim L'Chaim, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg of blessed memory, and actually they both gave me the exact same answer, which I thought was fascinating and also a very important answer, which was they said that even though it's true that she's not currently sick, so that should seem to limit what you can do halachically, the gene itself has a halachic status. The status the gene has is the status of a rodef. A rodef means, by halacha, right, we can't go killing people, right? We're not allowed to kill. Well, we're not allowed to murder. But if someone is chasing you to kill you, you're allowed to kill them. If you have no other choice, you can kill them to stop them. So the rodef is considered the murderer, right? And the rodef is the gene. She already has the gene. And since she has the gene, even though she doesn't currently have cancer, she can do what's necessary to prevent the cancer because the rodef is already there. And so removing the ovaries is permissible because of the rodef. And I thought that was a fascinating answer. And actually, that answer has saved life. And I know firsthand of women who would not have done it, but thanks for that answer, and it prevented it. The question then becomes really, at what age to do it? Because oftentimes women want to first have children and then have the surgery. But thankfully today we have many more technologies. I don't have time to go into all of them now, but those include egg freezing. So one can actually freeze their eggs, then have the ovaries removed, and then later have children. But that was a fascinating psak. That was only an issue because we realized it was happening. And the status of genes has a very, very important status in halacha. And thankfully, poskim are beginning to realize that. In fact, this is even happening today. There's cases, you know, in Israel where genes are being used for halachic status. You know, there's the case going on right now as we speak of the Yalde Teiman. There was the whole controversy in Israel where there was Yemenite children, a number of them, I think 300 children that died in Israeli hospitals. And some people accused the hospitals of foul play because so many kids died suddenly. And also they were buried in mass graves. No one, parents got to see their children and know that they died. There was even some people who accused the hospitals of selling their babies to like Ashkenazi women or something who wanted to adopt them. There was all these controversies. And right now in Israel, they've actually got permission from rabbis to exhume some of the graves and check their DNA compared to their grandparents or their parents to see if that's who they really are. And actually they've done two so far and they confirmed. And they confirmed that those were their children, that in fact they did die as children in the hospitals. And the rabbis allowed this, because usually we don't dig up graves, but the rabbis allowed it for the sake of, number one, the you know, just the peace of mind of their parents who all this time thought maybe their children are still alive, maybe there was foul play. Number two, to put a marker over their grave so people could go there to pray. And number three, so they could, people could like say Kaddish and pray for them. They allowed this, and it, all this was from the DNA. The genes have the status. The DNA now has status of a siman mufak in halacha. So it's just fascinating to see the way halacha is taking into account modern modern innovations in science and how important it is to be kept up to date, up to speed with all the modern innovations, because halacha needs to know about these things, and they become very, very relevant, and the rabbis who are making these decisions need to really understand. I'll conclude with one story that I think summarizes that point. And I'm not sure, this, God forbid, should not be taken in any ways criticize rabbis, but this is to make the point, and I know your rabbi happens to be someone who's a really mitsuyan, a really incredible rabbi, who knows what he's doing, but it's just to emphasize the point of to know what we're talking about and know what's happening. I remember we once had a patient, I talked about DNRs earlier. Some rabbis, some Jews are under the mistaken impression that Judaism never allows a DNR, do not resuscitate order. That's not true. Even though, as we said, we err on the side of prolonging life, we don't prolong death or the dying process. So we had this family who was very aggressively saying that we don't allow DNR. The doctors were telling them, you know, the patient is terminal. He's suffering. He's dying. The family said, we don't care. Our rabbi said, we called our rabbi. He said, Judaism prohibits DNR. We will not allow DNR. Nothing to talk about. So we said, okay, no, we'll accommodate. We want to accommodate religious beliefs. And even if we don't agree, that's what their rabbi said. We will respect it. But a few days, and we had a few meetings. They wouldn't budge. A few days later, I get a call in my office. The son of the patient says, Rabbi, I want to make sure that my father's code status is no code. I said, come again? He said, yeah, I want to make sure he's no code. I said, but I thought this whole time we've been saying that you're against DNR. He said, oh, yeah, no, DNR. We're opposed to DNR. We don't want that. So I said, you know, let's talk in person. I remember I went up to the room. I said, can you explain to me? Because really, in medical language, no code means DNR. You said you wanted to be no code, but you don't want DNR. So he said, I don't know. I'm not sure the terms, Rabbi. All I know is in the ICU, like most ICUs, the doors up to the rooms are glass, and the floor is in a kind of a horseshoe shape, and you can a little bit see into other rooms. And I heard, all of a sudden, I heard bells ringing and lights flashing, and they said, code blue, code blue. When that happened, dozens of people went rushing into the room next to my father's room. They're pounding on his stomach. I see them pushing in lines, IV lines into his chest, and pushing in medications, pounding on his chest. They intubate, they push the tube into his, down his throat. I see blood splashing. People are yelling. His body's flailing. And after half an hour of that, finally they said, what time is it? They called the time. He had died. And I said to the nurse, what was that? She said, that's a code blue. So I don't know what it was, but I don't want that. I said, okay, we need to call your rabbi, because this is what we've been trying to explain, that in your father's situation, that's what they would do if you want full code, even though he's so frail and dying. So I called the rabbi. I explained this, the whole story to the rabbi. The rabbi says, oh, that's what DNR means? I thought, oh gosh, he's been guiding this family all along without even knowing what the words mean. Now, this is not common. I want to be clear. Rabbis usually know what they're talking about. They usually have the integrity to say if they don't know what they're talking about, that they don't know. This was one particular person who didn't know what he was doing, and unfortunately he gave very bad advice because he didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know the actual metzius. He didn't just know the basic medical. He could have at least Googled it. I mean, so this, just to summarize, goes to show that the importance of being up to date with what's happening medically, with knowing the specific case. I personally will never answer a question. When someone calls me and says, oh, Rabbi, what did we say about this and that? I say, let me talk to the doctor. Let me find out the exact specifics. We need to understand every case is different case by case. These issues are really life and death issues that are involve some of the most serious and significant halachos and Jewish values that exist. And thankfully, we have great, great rabbis who know what they're talking about and really are able to guide us. But we need to make sure to be able to guide, to ask the proper questions. And through that, we can live a life of halacha, of Jewish values. And I have found, and I see this consistently, that when people are able to follow Jewish law and Jewish values, especially at the end of life, it mitigates a lot of the stress and the pain and the grief and the guilt and the family strife that often goes along with the end of life. And thankfully, it can provide us with guidance, with support, and a sense that actually the wisdom of our tradition and really God is guiding us and is with us in these difficult cases. And through the merit of that, May we all know arichas yamim v'shani. May you all have good health and long lives and happiness. May we all know many simchas together with your wonderful rabbis and your wonderful community. But may we all celebrate together in Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh. I'm happy to take any questions or discuss anything for the last minute or two we have here.
This is something that has to do with that law. But we did say maybe you'd share a book being a kidney donor.
Sure. You broke up a little bit. You said you'd share a little bit about being a kidney donor?
Your journey.
Sure, yeah. I'll just share it. I'm happy to just share the basics is that, as you see from this discussion, my whole life is basically involved with medical halacha, medical ethics, medical issues. I spend all my time in a hospital. And I've always been an advocate and encouraged people that, live altruistic kidney donation is a wonderful mitzvah. Whenever I heard about patients in my hospital that had donated a kidney, I always made sure to go up and praise them and talk to them and spend time, just tell them how much I respect them. And, oftentimes they all told me they only have one regret. Their one regret is that they can't do it again. And I was always very impressed by that, but I always thought, it's not for me. I'm very concerned about my health and I don't know, I could do that, but I thought it was a good thing. And then a friend of mine, needed a kidney and they did a swabbing event to see if anyone was a match. And I swabbed because I thought it's the right thing to do and I wanted to be a good role model. And thankfully I wasn't a match. I mean, I say thankfully because I was very nervous about it and I wasn't a match, and thankfully someone else was a match. In fact, he got a kidney here at the hospital I work at, and I got to visit him and his donor, and it was really beautiful. And then a year and a half later I got a call that I'm a match for someone, a total stranger in Toronto. And it, as it turns out, everyone is given a rank. Let's say there's 70, that means 70% of people will not be a match for them. Well, I was told that there's a woman in Toronto, a Jewish woman, who is a 100, which means 100% of people will not match her, which really means, 99.99999%. They said, and you are a perfect match for her. So I was like, wow, I couldn't believe it. I was really shocked. I called Rav Usher Weiss. His first response was, what does your wife say? I was like, yep, I have to talk to her. He's like, you can't even move forward unless she's fully supportive. That's the first thing. Number two, do you have anyone in your family who might need a kidney? I checked and I didn't. He said, you're not obligated. It's not an obligation by Jewish law, but it's a huge mitzvah. It's a gewaldige zchus. If you can do it, it's an amazing thing, but you're not obligated. And I just sort of felt, maybe I have to put my kidney where my mouth is, so to speak. I've been speaking about it. I've been praising it. Can I do it? And I started to go through the process and I started to get kind of excited about it, actually. I was terrified, but I started to feel like, maybe I could do something and really save a life, something that I never thought I could do. And maybe I could be a role model for others as well. And then I went through the process and 3 months ago, I donated my kidney.
Recording stopped.
And Baruch Hashem, 3 months ago, I donated my kidney and I feel great. I made sure to make it clear to everyone that I did this because of Jewish values and hopefully it was a Kiddush Hashem and it was Judaism that encouraged me. And the recipient is extremely grateful, obviously. And she told me actually she was getting worse and worse. And it was really, it was an amazing school. So it was really, I think, and actually looking back, one of the most profound and important things I've done in my life. And so thank God I had that opportunity.
Let me just say, does anyone want to ask a question? So I will take one by one favor.
Sure.
A grown person from donating their organs, donating the kidney after death.
Yeah, after death. That's a good question. Well, no, I would not discourage it, but it is a very different issue. Meaning donating a kidney when someone's alive is very broadly encouraged. It's a beautiful thing that all the rabbis really encourage if someone's healthy enough and they can do it. After death is a different issue because, first of all, if one puts it on their driver's license, then that death will be determined based on however the hospital determines death, not based on Jewish law, and they will have total access, meaning they won't have to even ask your family member or your durable power of attorney because you have decided, and they see that as your decision, and you don't get to ask around your family. It's they simply take your organs. So if that's something you want to do, okay, you can save 8 lives. I mean, it is a beautiful thing, but I mean, I had a case once where we had a 16-year-old kid who was in a car accident, and he was, unfortunately, he was declared brain dead. And when the family arrived, the doctors had declared him dead. And the next day, they sort of said, like, okay, no, say goodbyes, and his organs are all perfect matches, and we're going to be retrieving his organs. And the family said, whoa, 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 you didn't ask us. Like, we didn't give permission for that. We have to ask our rabbi. And the hospital said, no, it's on his driver's license. Like, we don't ask you in those cases. And actually, it wasn't the hospital. It was the organ procurement organization, separate entity. So that's one risk. The other issue is definition of death. It depends. You have to ask your rabbi, meaning most posthumous organ donation is only really possible if one accepts death by neurological criteria, by brain death. Many rabbis do accept brain death, and by them, then one can retrieve organs if they are dead based on their rabbi has agreed to it and their family's agreed to it. And it's, you know, because by declaring death by Jewish law, those who accept it is stricter, actually, than American law. But many, many, many rabbis do not accept brain death as the halakhic criteria of death. And to those, most posthumous organ donation is not possible. There is some still that can be done. In some centers, there's some ways of retrieving kidneys and corneas and skin, things like that. And that could be possible by halakha, but it's just much more complicated after death. So as much as I encourage it for a live donor, if someone's able to and they want to, after death, it's much more complicated. You have to consult with your rabbi, and there's many more issues, but it can still be a huge mitzvah and huge kiddush Hashem and save, you know, up to 8 lives. So it still can be a great thing with many caveats.
It seems like you're very involved and integrated in the care team. Can you talk about how that's arranged in your hospital, and is that something you actively cultivate?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it's been a high priority of me and our chaplaincy department to be involved with the team so we can provide support. So we, like palliative care, for example, we have a chaplain stationed full time with them, and especially our highest acuity units, we have chaplains stationed on the units. We also find, you know, we have a lot of very religious patients of various religions, and often we try to accommodate. You know, we are a Jewish hospital, and we believe that it's important to accommodate religious values of any religion. And as long as we're able to be, you know, flexible and work well with the team and with the patients and develop proper relationships with the local clergy and show the medical team that there's value added in having us involved because we can work well with the patients and find oftentimes compromises and solutions and ways of moving forward in otherwise what seem to be intractable situations, then they're more likely to call us back next time. And so we've found that there's been a strong integration with our ICUs, with our palliative care, with our emergency room. And, you know, we believe that's important as a Jewish hospital, but also just to provide excellent patient-centered care that's important to, you know, respect their values, but also know how to be able to navigate, you know, medicine properly. It's a great question, though. It's an important issue.
Great. Thank you so much, Ray Weiner. We really appreciate it.